Hi, this is Barry Luce at INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. The residual effect of the Great Recession that started in 2007 has hit American states severely in 2011. Many must severely cut back budgets and services to their residents. These problems have filtered down to medium-sized cities and even small, wealthy suburbs, and they must now make difficult choices to balance their budgets. In today's segment, we talk to Dr. Kenneth Chelst, Professor of Operations Research at Wayne State University. Dr. Chelst has long consulted police and fire departments, as well as municipalities across the country. He's presenting his findings at the INFORMS Conference on Analytics in Chicago in April 2011. Professor Chelst, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you.
We had a chance to talk during the INFORMS annual meeting in the fall of 2010, and at the time, you warned me that there would be severe budget cuts at the state level this year. What did you see coming down the pike at that time?
Well, first, I saw that the real estate taxes were declining, were still declining in many states, and all of the predictions that in a number of these states it would not return to norms for 5 or more years. I saw state governments being forced to use up all their rainy day funds and now address structural issues, so it was clear they would one day be cutting back on revenue sharing. And the stimulus package that President Obama had put in place included significant sums of money to keep public sector employees on the job, police, fire, teachers, and that money was going to be running out in the summer of 2011.
Yeah, I find it interesting that that last point has not been mentioned much in the debate about budget in the U.S. Congress and elsewhere. Be that as it may, an article that appeared in the New York Times on March 23rd said that states are passing budget pains along to cities. Why are they doing that, and what are they doing?
Well, states have to have a balanced budget. That's a requirement in almost every state constitution on an annual basis. Now, on a one-year basis, they can play games and move some revenue around, but when a recession lasts for 2 or 3 years, they have to start cutting back funds. And one of the things that many states have been doing in good times was revenue sharing, in which they just sent bundles of money that they collected at the state level back to the cities. That has been one of the easier targets to try to cut back. And so that share of funds that cities often had is essentially drying up.
You live in Michigan. What is Michigan Governor Rick Snyder proposing?
So the governor is actually taking a rather creative approach. He is reviewing all the revenue sharing, and he will be cutting it back significantly. But he's made a proposal, and we'll see if it actually makes it through the legislature, that a significant portion of the revenue sharing would be allocated to cities that are taking initiative to do creative strategies like merging services, merging dispatch centers. He's even using the city of Kalamazoo as a good example of a city in which the same person is trained to be a policeman and a fireman to handle all sorts of emergencies. So he's putting out a carrot to encourage cities to be more creative and more efficient in the way they deliver emergency services in particular.
And mergers of services, as you've just described, is an opportunity, but obviously there are political barriers. Do you want to discuss that a little bit, especially the barriers?
Yeah, there are two types of barriers. The bigger barrier, America has like 18,000, I think, police departments. An unbelievable number of political boundaries, and it makes very little sense to have that many departments. The question is, small and medium-sized cities have often not shared services that they could. At the other end of the spectrum, you have a city like Indianapolis, which has a combined county and city government. So trying to encourage cities, and the main thing is the politicians and the chiefs who have their jobs dependent upon being the police chief or the fire chief of a small locale, are going to be very reluctant to give up their authority and share it with a broader community. But that's probably the biggest opportunity that America nationwide has to reduce the overinvestment often in police and fire services. The second thing, which is harder from a union perspective, is to change the nature of the job and encourage a person to be both a police officer and firefighter. Those are some of the examples.
And I would assume that would take a longer horizon to realize it.
Actually, some small cities can get the benefits of a police and fire merger in a couple of years. Changing and also combining dispatch centers can actually be done in a year. It doesn't take as long as it sounds. The full benefits may take longer to achieve, but you can get your money back if there's often a startup cost. In a year or 2 years, and see the benefits pretty quickly.
You mentioned that Kalamazoo is a test case. How are they combining services in that Michigan city?
Well, in Kalamazoo, which is a city of over 70,000 people, they keep only one firefighter in most stations, and the police officers are dual trained to be policemen and firemen, and when a call comes in, the police units travel to the scene of the fire and don their fire gear, and they work with the fire equipment to put out fires. That's a model that exists in more than a dozen cities in the state of Michigan, and it works.
Is there data that confirms that it works?
Well, in terms of the data that it works, I mean, it's very hard to point out. It works from an efficiency perspective because you can get there faster. There's very little hard data on the risks in general that people face in terms of fire. So there's no reason to believe that getting somebody there sooner but with a little less equipment doesn't work in the vast, vast majority of cases. And when you have a major fire, it turns out, it's going to take a long time to get all the people there, and often you need mutual aid in any case. So it's hard to pinpoint whether or not there's any minor increase or in risk, or in fact it reduces the risk because now you have a police officer on the street who's also trained to fight a fire, and he can take, when one or two of them arrive at the scene quickly, they can take immediate action to at least get the process started. So it's really hard to measure outcomes, but the cities are happy with it, and some of the wealthiest suburbs in Michigan have such a model, and they're happy with it, and it's worked for more than several decades.
And what would a public safety department with dual-trained officers look like?
Depending upon its size, you might have somebody, a group of individuals who are in the fire stations on a round-the-clock basis to bring the equipment to the scene. But all of the police officers in the department would be trained to handle fires. They would also have some basic medical training to be a basic EMT, not an EMT, but some basic first responder capabilities. And they would carry their gear in their vehicle. Now, some of the more advanced departments in Florida actually have police officers patrolling in something other than a police car. They patrol in something that actually carries a couple hundred gallons of water or compressed air foam so they can put out small fires, which is the vast, vast majority of fires in suburban America.
I assume there is a difference between doing this in large cities and in smaller municipalities.
Well, yeah, and I mean, our image of the fire service is based on TV, and it's driven by New York City, Chicago. And in New York City, you have a lot of these five-story buildings with large numbers of apartments and buildings that are 60, 70, 80 years old. And you need a lot of people if a fire breaks out there in nighttime to rescue people. But in many of the suburbs that I live in, the vast majority of houses are one-story or two-story, and they're single-occupied or maybe they're two-family houses. You don't need as many resources, and in most cases, the vast, vast majority of time, the people are out of the house long before the firefighters arrive. So it's not as critical to get like 20 people quickly at the scene like it is in the city of New York or Chicago, which is sort of like the standard response to a building fire in New York or Chicago.
So two different models, one for New York and Chicago, and then another for other parts of the country.
Right.
Which brings us around to your work. How did you become part of the planning for these budget cuts in municipal services?
Well, I've been involved since my days at MIT in the mathematics of police work.
That was when you were an undergraduate or a graduate student?
When I did my PhD is in mathematical models of police modeling. So I started with Dick Larson's group and the New York City RAND Corporation in the mid-1970s. A colleague of mine who had been a police officer and moved up through the ranks and eventually switched to city government, 3 years ago left city government to help the International City and County Management Association provide guidance to city officials who are constantly being asked for more resources for police and fire services. So he created this group. My team provides data analysis support, but it also includes former police officials of major cities and former fire and EMS officials of major cities and counties. And we're there to help city managers whose budget is often 70% of it is allocated to police and fire services, and yet they have little understanding of the value and role of, in terms of the cost-effective role of police and delivery of fire and police services. So they needed help to deal with the issues of managing police and fire services. So it's a team of experienced city officials, police officials, fire officials, and people like me who do the analytics, and we provide the support analysis for their recommendations.
And what trade-offs do you consider? For example, how do you help a locality decide if it should cut back on police officers whose salaries might be comparatively high and substitute civilians, for example?
So the number one thing the analytics first shows and documents that city officials have never seen before, it is the emergency service workload of their police and fire services. They are only told by their officials, well, we respond to 20,000 calls or 10,000 calls, but they don't have any sense that that workload translates to no more than 5% of the time for a fire officer and 20, 30% of the time for a police official to be busy at calls. We then document that the vast, vast majority of calls are not emergency calls. So the question is, for the non-emergency calls, can you create alternative strategies for delivering those services, and in some cases not delivering that service at all? Do you really need to respond to every alarm knowing that 98% of those alarms are false? So the final balance, though, is really not made by me. The final recommendation is made by a former police official who can relate to the city managers and the police chiefs and help them make a judgment call, and it is a judgment call on the balance of providing civilians versus trained police officers to handle certain types of calls and activities.
And how do you use analytics with, say, a fire department? How do you examine the current usage of resources and help towns and small cities reduce their fire budgets while protecting people's lives?
So, as I said, the first thing is to document the workload, the emergency service workload, to make cities aware of how serious a fire situation they face. And the related question is, do you need as much fire resources? We looked at a city in California with 300,000 people with 14, 15 fire stations, and they're struggling with the union contracts, and they had no idea of how serious a fire problem they have. And the first thing we document is, well, at least according to the data, there's only 300 so-called structure fires. And then we educate city officials that a structure fire includes a pot burning on the stove, that gets labeled as a structure fire. And we're able to document how often they actually fight fires. And then we're able to document how often people are actually at risk. So that now they have a more rational understanding that perhaps they overinvested in their fire service, and that, yes, there's a minor risk of if you close down one fire station or two fire stations throughout the city, those risks are extremely small, and they're reasonable risks. And the question is, how much insurance does it, fire insurance, does a city, can a city afford in this day and age? So that's one issue. The other issue is, we, in one case, we're looking at four cities that are neighboring one another and say, it makes no sense not to share resources. When you have a major fire, you need mutual aid in any case. A major fire occurs once a year, twice a year, three times a year. So you need to look at a shared model of resources rather than trying to staff your city alone to handle the rare fire. So it's giving them a real sense of what the magnitude of the fire situation is in their particular locale.
And do you have to start using different metrics? Is the data that's available sufficient to let you make these conclusions?
Well, there are two types of data. There's the computer-aided dispatch data, and in many cities, unfortunately, it's never been looked at. So one of the first things is we have to actually document whether it's accurate, and we spend a lot of time clarifying it. We often show, one of the major findings we have is that they can cut response time by a minute or more without adding any more resources. In fact, all they need to do is change the model of dispatching. We found in a number of cities that the dispatchers wait to gather every piece of information about the nature of the call, and only after doing that do they hit the button to send the emergency response unit to the scene. That can take 2.5 minutes. Instead, they really should be gathering the name, the location, a brief description, and hit the button in a half a minute. If you can cut 2 minutes from the response time, that would save more time in response than adding another fire station or two fire stations or three fire stations. So they're wasting precious time in areas that can be easily cut and make them more efficient, and then they can afford to have fewer resources spread throughout the city and still meet a reasonable standard of quick response.
That sounds like an important insight. You face similar problems with police departments. What redundancies do you identify when you study the many police departments in a state?
So in the police departments, there the data is more complicated. There's a lot more data. But what we're finding in many suburban cities, we typically look up to 100,000, 150,000, although we are looking at a much larger city with 750,000 people. We find a lot of specialized units that have been created over the years. A number of cities have a specialized canine unit that doesn't routinely respond to calls for service, but could. We find specialized traffic units, and we document that the average police officer is not that busy with calls for service, so he or she could easily handle the traffic responsibility. You don't need a specialized traffic unit. So there's been a major growth of specialized units that aren't needed, that the regular police officer is not that busy with calls for service, and there's this image in some cities that they're running from call to call to call, when we can document that through most times of the day, calls for service occupy no more than 30% of a police officer's time, and a significant portion of that is traffic-related. So cities have to decide how much they want to invest in their police services. We just presented a report to a city called Troy, Michigan. It's a public record. It was in the city council videotape. And our job was not to help the city cut resources, it was to document that if the city officials decide to cut the department by 30% over the next 3 years, it would still be a viable functioning department, and we were able to document that based on workloads, along with other recommendations about how to manage calls for service, they could afford to operate a police department that would be no bigger than what it was in 1978.
Those of us who live in larger cities may not know much about city managers. But as you mentioned earlier, you've been working with them through the International City and County Management Association, ICMA. How are you and the association using analytics to deal with these problems?
Well, the starting point is at every annual conference, we give a talk to a jam-packed audience, and the title of the talk is, "What are the tough questions you should be asking your police and fire chiefs?" So you look at something like, and most cities, although run by a city council and a mayor, hire professionals called city managers to run their cities. And these professionals have little training in the areas of managing police and fire services, even though they account for 70% of their budgets. I mean, an article about Reading, Pennsylvania talked about a police and fire budget that was $40 million, and their total revenues for the city is only $30 million this year. So they don't have any understanding of what is the magnitude of the investment in police and fire services, and all they hear is that if you cut it back, you'll be putting lives at risk. And there is no data that that's in fact the case. So we help them ask their senior officials that operate their services, what would happen if we did cut resources by 20% or 30%? What would it mean in terms of response time? Can you document response time? Can you explain what the workloads are? So they're asking these city, the police and fire executives to take a harder look at the data, basically the analytics. And that's where my team comes in to support, you know, our consulting group, which is we document through a detailed analysis of data, occasionally using a sophisticated OR model to predict response time or queuing delays, but more often just clearly articulating what does the data say about the workloads, about the nature of the risks that the community faces. And that level of education is eye-opening to both to city officials, and it gives them the ammunition to educate their communities when there's a major political backlash where public service officials try, with police and fire officials, try to rally the city to demand that there be no cuts in police and fire services.
One thing that you do is rare event analysis. What is it? Why is it important?
Well, ultimately, when you're dealing with emergency services, you can't talk just only about averages, you know, or else we'd never need anything to prepare for, you know, extreme emergencies. So in one city, we documented what was the worst hour in the 7,680 hours in a year in terms of, as an example, of what an extreme situation might look like. And we found that even under those circumstances, that significantly more resources than they would might need. But the main message that we give to small and medium-sized cities, the rare major fire, you can't handle anyway on your own. You need mutual aid. You're going to be calling neighboring cities. You may be calling in your paid-on-call volunteers. So the question is, how much do you need staff on a daily basis for the routine? And then when there's a rare emergency, you can't staff up for that in any case, and you're going to have mutual aid. You need to prepare those mutual aid agreements, which is pretty common in the police, in the fire services, and understand that's how you're going to handle a rare emergency in any case, so you don't need a staff on a daily basis with full-time employees in fire stations working less than 30 minutes in a 24-hour day at calls for service.
At the Informs conference, you'll be talking about a fire study plan you conducted based on 1 year's data. Tell us a little bit about the findings. I understand that the risk of fire, as you mentioned earlier, is decreasing, especially in newly constructed buildings.
Yeah. The fire data that's out there from the National Fire Service is potentially very interesting if it actually described, if people actually filled it in. For example, it would tell you whether or not they actually put water on a fire, and in most cases, fires are actually out. I read the 300 so-called structure fires for the city. I read the narrative for each one, and the key question I was looking at, how many times are they involved in any type of fire rescue of an individual? We have these images, again, from TV of carrying people out of buildings in the midst of fires. In this city of 300,000, that never happened in a year. Twice they woke somebody up on the kitchen floor, and there was a stove on fire. Once, I think they found the person in bed, and I think they got him out. And yes, once there was a fatality, but it was probably not due to a fire because they found the person hanging in a closet. It was probably a cover-up fire. So to see that the nature of the risk on an annual basis is that small, that's eye-opening to city officials. Now, and that changes the perspective on what issues and how do you begin addressing a situation when in many newer communities we don't have a major fire problem in terms of risk to human beings on a daily basis. Now, that's different from Detroit where there are tragedies on a monthly basis, but that's not true in suburban America where people are rarely at risk in their single and two-family homes that they live in. They're usually out of their homes. I read many narratives where they talked about speaking to the people who are out on the street when the fire department arrived on scene.
You've also looked at emergency medical services. What kinds of observations have you made that would improve efficiency, save dollars, and continue to safeguard lives?
Well, emergency medical is an interesting phenomenon. Fire departments, because they have so little fires to do, have stepped into a gap to provide that service often in many small cities. But actually, there are much more efficient models for providing emergency services. In the state of Michigan, there's a pretty strong nonprofit ambulance service that's providing a different model of service. They're willing to station a paramedic on the street, awake all hours of the day, to provide immediate initial response while the ambulance travels and arrives maybe 2, 3, 4 minutes later to help with transport and assist at the scene. This type of model of a paramedic first responder is an order of magnitude, not an order of magnitude, but significantly less costly than a fire service model. These types of individuals are paid on the order of $20 an hour, $25 an hour. Fire services might be costing you $50, $75 an hour for the same people. And whereas this ambulance, this paramedic in a vehicle getting to the scene first, is awake 24 hours a day so he can respond or she can respond immediately when a call comes in, even at 2 a.m., in contrast to the model of a fire service where they're sitting in a fire station. When a call comes in, on the best that they can do is get out in a minute to a minute and a half, and at night they get out in 2.5 minutes. It's hard to compare that service to somebody who's in a vehicle ready to go. And yes, he's only one person, but that's the critical first person to get the treatment started. And if you wait another couple of minutes to get additional services there, that's a very cost-effective model that a number of cities throughout Michigan are seriously considering and implementing. The other advantage of that model is it's important in the emergency medical service area that a person have a lot of experience in handling regular emergencies. And when you have this type of individual handling more calls for service, he will have more opportunities to use his regular skills than many of the firefighters who share more calls among more fire stations and don't have an opportunity to use their skills as frequently. So I think that's an excellent model that's being considered seriously in a number of locales in Michigan.
Another issue that you've looked at is workloads. What are you finding out about workloads and ways that schedules can be redone to save taxpayer dollars?
Okay. So one of the biggest issues in many states is the negotiated contracts that restrict the hours that people can work. And many city officials do not understand the impact of their schedules, especially in the police department, on providing a non-match deployment level with the calls for service. For example, a very popular schedule among police officers is a 10-hour schedule where they work only 4 days a week. It ensures that every other weekend they have a 3-day week off. 10-hour shifts, especially if you only use 3 starting times, is extremely, extremely inefficient because it provides 30 hours of coverage in a 24-hour day for up to 6 hours, you have twice as many officers on the street, and you almost never, ever need that many officers at any one time. In some cases, they carry it even to a further extreme, and they create schedules that are even better for the police officers to get them more weekends, longer weekends off. And in one city we looked at, they had 3 to 4 times as many officers as they need when they had overlaps. It was so bad that they had to put 2 men in a car because they didn't have enough cars. And these were negotiated agreements, and city officials are negotiating contracts with work clauses that are very, very inefficient for the city, especially in the area of police work.
So to recap briefly, what major recommendations as an operations researcher are you making for fire, police, and EMS?
Perhaps the thing that upsets many people is we're saying that in many suburban communities, you know, 50, 100,000 populations, city officials have overinvested in police and fire services, and they can actually make do with less. The demands for these services, although in total numbers may look like they're growing, in terms of the emergencies that they're facing, it isn't growing. And with technology and better dispatch systems and with better data, they should be able to manage with less. In some cases, they may need to cut back on services. They may need to pass laws penalizing people for false alarms and enforce them, but that they can make do with less. The other thing, and this is the bigger challenge, and which the governor of Michigan is seriously considering, cities really have to seriously consider sharing resources. In this day and age, there's very, very little reason for every small to medium-sized city to have its own dispatch operation. They should be sharing dispatch centers almost at the county level. And they should also be sharing more police resources. So those are the major, bigger challenges ahead. And then the issue of not having restrictive contracts that restrict the flexibility of city officials to make appropriate changes in police and fire resource allocation.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Kenneth Chelst of Wayne State University, who's speaking at the Informs Analytics Conference in Chicago in April 2011. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.